Have you ever wondered why exactly it is that things usually sound better at home than they do on stage, in auditions, or even in lessons? It's easy to chalk it up to nerves or assume that you just have to practice more or get more performance experience. And sure, those things certainly are part of the puzzle, but a lot of times that's not really the true root cause. If you've been confused by the inconsistency of your performances, I put together a free 4-minute quiz called the Mental Skills Audit, which will help you pinpoint your mental strengths and weaknesses and figure out what exactly to adjust and tweak in your preparation for more consistently optimal performances. You can take the Mental Skills Audit online at bulletproofmusician.com/MSA. That's MSA for Mental Skills Audit. And again, it's 100% free, and it'll take just 4 minutes to get your results emailed to you as a PDF. This is Noah Kageyama, and you're listening to the Bulletproof Musician Podcast. Every Sunday morning, we'll take a look at a new research-based tip or technique to help you practice more effectively or perform better under pressure. And on the first Sunday of every month, I'll have a guest from the music, sport, or research world who will share their insights on how we can all be a little more awesome in the practice room and on stage. Today, I'll be chatting with bassoonist Benjamin Kamens, who is a former member of the Minnesota and Houston Symphonies and is currently on the faculty of Rice University's Shepherd School of Music. In today's episode, Ben shares insights on learning to play with more ease and less judgment and how becoming a certified Alexander Technique teacher has shaped his practicing, performing, and teaching. Ben also provides details on the nuances of reed making, how to do slow practice, and deal more effectively with challenges in certain passages or misbehaving reeds. So you've had this terrific performing and teaching career as a member of the Minnesota Orchestra, then the Houston Symphony, and in the historical performance world as well, and also as a member of the faculty at Rice for many years. And you're also a certified Alexander Technique teacher. So I'd love to hear how this has impacted your playing and performing, practicing and teaching. And I wonder if a good place to start might be your Alexander Technique origin story, or like how it is that you were first exposed to it or came across it, and we'll go from there.
So I was exposed to the Alexander Technique for the first time probably when I was about 21 or 2. And I was friends with some people in the St. Paul Chamber Orchestra when I was in the Minnesota Orchestra. This would have been back in the mid-70s. And they were bringing teachers in. There were many fewer Alexander teachers at the time. And they brought in a guy who probably had studied with Alexander. His name was Goddard Binkley, who looked a little bit like a wrestler. And I quickly lost interest in the Alexander Technique. And I can't say that I remember much from that time. But it was in my memory that it existed. My dear colleague who just retired from Rice, Leone Bisey, started to bring in a woman from Dallas. This would have been in the 90s. And I took a few lessons then, didn't get on. But what really got me going was in, and this is not uncommon in the Alexander world, I went backpacking in the year 2000 and I broke my pinky. So in the Alexander Technique, there's jargon and everything. We use the word use, which means the way you use your entire mind, body, self, whole mind, body, organism. So what had happened is that it was a tiny break and I came back, but it had thrown off my entire organization with the bassoon. So that when I came back, even though it was a tiny break and I'd done all the things with the physical therapist and what I was supposed to do, I couldn't organize myself and I couldn't, you know, the bassoon involves a lot of thumb, you know, strange stuff with your hands. I just couldn't reach the keys. And I'm doing this physical therapy, and I'm not very pleased about this, to put it mildly. And I had a great physical therapist, and she said, you know, you ought to try the Alexander Technique, followed by my eye roll, since the last experience I'd had with it had not been very positive. But fortunately, the teacher I got at that point was a local teacher in Houston, Chris Lidvall, and I got along great. And I was a really bad student at it in that I was a slow learner. And I'm generally not a good student because I have to feel like I've figured it all out myself, whether I really do or not. It's just a quirk of my personality. And so I stuck with it because I just figured I really needed something. And gradually, I got out of my situation. And ultimately, my organization with the bassoon was better than it had been even before that because I had really been going down a rabbit hole of bad, or a rabbit hole of challenging, excuse me. Let's get that going. And I studied it for about 10 years, and I did some workshops and continued lessons with Chris. And then in 2010, my wife, Janet Rarick, who, of course, you know well, this is how many of the really best things in my life have ever happened. Janet says, Chris is starting a training program to be teachers. I think we ought to do it. And I went, okay. And so I started this training program, mostly because, you know, Janet had said that. And if I had been in the Houston Symphony still at the time, I wouldn't have been able to do it because it was one long weekend a month, you know, really all day for 3 or 4 days. And it lasted for me, four and a half years because I had to finish up some commitments. And, you know, people say, oh, such and such changed my life. I don't say that kind of thing really lightly or often, but I can honestly say that becoming an Alexander teacher has changed my life for the better. That's my origin story.
So now that you left it as Alexander Technique changed my life for the better, I can't just leave it there. Can you say more about some of the ways, and I'm just guessing, I'm just making assumptions. I don't know if it's related to your playing or your teaching or practicing. I'm sure it relates to those things, but maybe even other things outside of music. But yeah, I'd love to hear more about some of this.
It's easy for me to tell you that my organizational aspects with the instrument, my sense of ease while I'm playing, my awareness of looking for the ways that make it easier to play, the ways it has helped me with my students. You know, when a student would come in and say, I have a problem with such and such, and but before I would go, well, you know, just practice your scale slowly or something not useful like that, or gee, go see a physicist. I had ways of actually potentially, I'm not going to say it helped everybody, potentially addressing problems beyond that. That was one way that it's really helped me. It helped me with my own playing in that way. But I think that one of the most important ways, and this is often one of the things that our students in our Alexander classes tell Janet and me that was one of the most important things they received from the class, is the ability to stop judging myself when in my playing and as a human being. And instead of looking at my quirks and looking at my personality, looking at the problems in my playing, looking at the problems I was encountering as information, not as good and bad. So I look at the situation for myself, say, oh, I'm having trouble articulating this passage, or I've screwed something up in a concert, therefore I'm a jerk. You know, I've practiced it 1,000 times, I screw it up in the concert, so therefore I'm a bad person on some level because I did that. And I think most performing musicians have had those feelings. And so I'm much better able to look at that, not that it's as easy to do, but look at that information and say, oh, what can I learn from this thing that was deeply embarrassing or seemed like I had failed in some way? It's not so much, this is a failure. What can I learn from this? Now, it sounds like I'm being like, I just do this now and it's like falling off a log. No, it's always a struggle, but I'm aware of this and I'm better at it. The Alexander Technique, like learning to play any musical instrument, is a practice. You have to practice it. You're not going to continue to play the violin well if you don't practice. However, you choose to find an efficient way of doing it. And that's true of the technique. So people do it and they say, gee, it was great while I was doing it. And, you know, and then I stopped doing it. And they say, yeah, but it didn't stick. Well, does playing your instrument stick if you don't practice? So it's just like that. It's peeling away the layers and learning something with greater depth all the time. By no means am I suggesting it's the right thing for everybody. By no means am I suggesting that's what everybody who studies it should do. I just think that that's true. And I think it's true of a lot of things. And I've learned a lot, just an enormous number of life lessons along this vein.
Do you have a sense of how that mindset shift happens? I mean, is it a product of how it changes how you approach practicing? Or how did the students get to that point where they're able to look at things with a little less judgment and more, it sounds like with more curiosity about the mechanisms?
Yeah, I think, you know, like so many mindfulness techniques, and that I think something that is essentially similar amongst all of them. And the Alexander Technique is, yes, a mindfulness technique. You know, I can sit and tell you how I think it's different than straight mindfulness training, but that's not so much the issue. Is it helps people to exist in the moment. And one of the main things that takes us out of the moment is judgment. You know, somebody's playing something they've practiced many, many times, and they're playing along and they screw something up. And so what do they immediately do? They look back at it while they're still in playing. They look back at it and they screw up where they are then. Or, oh, there's that hard passage coming up. You know, and so what do you do is, I'm going to start worrying about that now. And then what happens? They screw up where they are. They aren't even at theoretically the hard passage. Or it tenses them up ahead of time. So when they get to the passage, you know, this is predicated on that they know they've practiced it and they know what the notes are. If you don't know what the notes are, you're just surprised when you see a note. That's a completely different thing. The technique has been helpful to me, and it's helpful to my students at giving them a way of staying in the moment so that they don't, so that not unnecessary tension, unnecessary muscular activity. And when I say that, it's a mind-body connection element to that, happens in the moment of while they are playing. Does it work every time? Of course not. Is it helpful? Yes. I'll tell you a personal story about this. So as having played principal bassoon in the Houston Symphony for a little over 20 years, and I played in Minnesota before that. I played in orchestras for 30 years, approximately. I played the Rite of Spring a number of times. I played it in Houston, played it in New York, you know, played it around, played it some summer festivals. So the problem is the Rite of Spring is arguably the most well-known bassoon solo in the repertoire. And you can tell that because 3 weeks before you're about to play it, it's coming up on the subscription series, somebody in the second violin section walks by you in the hall and starts singing it to you. And, you know, my thought is, gee, really? But so there's this, in your own mind, it develops this expectation. So I developed a response to the startle reflex. The startle reflex, of course, it manifests itself as fight, flight, or freeze. I'm sure any number of people who have done this with you have mentioned startle. I'm sure you've mentioned it many times. And so I developed this thing. So I'd start the piece. First note would come out. And then you have to hold that high C for a little bit. And then you have to do a grace note with the middle finger of your left hand. That's what you have to do. And over the course of holding the C, I would freeze up in that finger due to my fear that the grace note isn't going to be clean. So I developed a technique that worked every single time I've ever performed it, which is I'm going to hold the first note for three beats in my mind, and on four, I'm going to play. Not at four and a half, not at three and a half, not at five. On four, I'm going to play, because if I don't play then, I'm going to hang out on that high C till forever. And what was happening before I became aware of this is over those four beats, I'm fretting more and more, and that finger is getting tighter and tighter, but I have no choice. At four, but yeah, do it. It worked, but it was deeply uncomfortable and terrifying to the point where my son, we're at dinner, he's probably in high school, says, "Hey, Dad, did you ever want to go bungee jumping?" And I said, "Danny, I don't need to go bungee jumping. I've played the Rite of Spring in Carnegie Hall." So when I realized this, what I said to myself, this is after I was really into the technique, I said, you know what I'm going to do? Instead of during those four beats, I'm still going to count it, the three beats and then moving on four, I am going to inhibit my tendency to tense in my middle finger, and I'm going to let my whole arm structure unclench. And all of a sudden, when I trained myself to do that, which is mostly through awareness and through choice, I was able to do this with ease. Now, that took real practice, and it took tremendous amount of discipline on myself to be able to do that, because it's inherently, you know, there's a lot of baggage to that. So this is the point, is that by making a choice to let go of this, that if I had screwed up the grace note, you would have thought that would have been the mistake. It wasn't the problem. Instead of going, oh, that's the mistake, which is pointing out what's wrong, I was able to come up with a solution to the problem. And that is something that I have really worked towards a lot in my own teaching in many ways, is instead of saying, oh, you're playing out of tune. You're still playing out of tune. Well, you must have a bum ear. You're playing out of tune. What's the point of saying that to somebody? Instead, how can we fix this? And in this case, it was through this awareness that I gained through my work with the technique. And this is something I really, really talk a lot about, because I have some very advanced students and they make mistakes and they're beating themselves up because they can't play through something without making a mistake. So we say, let's look at what the problem is. Assuming you know the piece, that you've done your woodshedding, you've learned it. The problem does not exist there because you're a great player. It exists in this losing the moment while you're playing it. Now, this takes real practice, and it's not something, there's no quick fix for this, but it has helped a lot of people. This is something I could not possibly have done before I studied the technique. It would have been, you just got to practice it more. Do your scales. You know, you're just putting in your time, but you're not really working. And sometimes I say stuff like that. I don't say like that. I've really practiced. I said, I know you have. You really have put in the time. Let's look at what you did with the time. And this is just one element of something that I do. You know, a lot of time is spent with students of trying to help them learn how to practice. And I'm not talking about high school kids. And I'm not even talking about undergraduates. I'm talking about graduate students that have not learned how to practice. And that's a big part of what it is, because I'm the only person in my school that can teach somebody these things. I can teach somebody how to play the bassoon. I'm the only one. There are other violin teachers at our school, but boy, I'm the only bassoon teacher. And I take that responsibility to helping these people to enjoy what they're doing incredibly seriously, more seriously than they realize, because I feel it as a, actually, this is going to sound corny, but I really mean this. I view this as a sacred responsibility.
Related to your point about teaching students how to practice who may not be using their time in the most effective way, and this might be too broad of a question, we can narrow it down, but you know, when you encounter or when a student encounters a really difficult passage, how do you approach that? You know, something that you can't quite play right now, and you know that it's probably within you to be able to play it, but you just can't do it right now. Is there like a particular process, or like how does one approach something like that if they encounter it?
You know, one of those first musician self-help books that came out was called A Soprano on Her Head. I'm sure you know that book by Eloise Ristad. And I read this book, and there was a story in there that I particularly liked, which was your friend has lent you, maybe you remember this, Noah, your friend has lent you their cabin for the weekend. And they've given you very explicit directions on how to get there. You have to go here. Here's the set of keys. And you have to go here. You have to get through this gate and use the green key for that. You have to go through this gate, use the purple key for that. I don't know. There was this very ornate set of directions to get to this place in the country. So you get to the first gate and you've got this keychain with a lot of keys on it. And there's a green key. You put the green key into the lock and it doesn't work. And you're stymied. You don't know what to do. So, you try it again. But ultimately, you look at your keys and you realize there's another green key. And you see the point of this story, obviously, which is you've got a lot of stuff that you know can work for some people. It's not all going to work for every person. So, do I say, well, you need to practice slowly? Yes, I think that by and large, to learn a piece so that your brain can catch up with what you see on the page, actually learn the notes, I think that is something that is necessary, is to practice slowly. Now, you encounter the problems in practicing slowly, which is it's not as easy to sense how you're tensing up before a passage, because the physicality of playing something fast is different than playing it slowly. So that brings in another element, which I know that you have spoken quite a bit about, which is in-tempo practicing, which is to practice something up to tempo. But in order to do that, what I recommend is practice very short segments of it, because you don't want to screw up. The whole point is if you mess something up, you've learned it a little bit that way. But up-tempo practicing, especially, for example, on a wind instrument, where once you get above the fundamentals on the instrument, you're dealing with jumping from one overtone series to another. And there's usually a little bit of a gap in terms of how a hesitation in the instrument with the resistance of how it changes. You have string crossings and you have lots of other things that are your own issues on string instruments. But that's one thing that doesn't work so well to learn from just practicing it slowly, because you can make those jumps and that amount of time it's mitigated by the fact that you're doing it slowly. So you have to practice things that way. So that's practicing in tempo, but small segments. There's another thing that works in some circumstances for some people. What I mentioned before is, all right, you know the piece. So now let's look at, we develop as I refer to it, you develop a thing about something. You know, that passage you're looking at, it's going, oh boy, I've got a thing. My thing was moving my finger in the Rite of Spring. That's a thing. And so what do you do? Well, you first of all, you acknowledge the fact that the mistake is not the problem. If you didn't know it, yeah, the mistake's the problem. But at this point, it's the tension that's the problem. It's the anxiety. It's the judgment of the situation that messes you up. We look at how to do that. So the point is that you try a lot of stuff and a lot of it works. One thing I don't do anymore is I don't beat the kids up. This is supposed to be fun. I like to say I'm the least judgmental person in the room, but I might be the most discerning. So I have to make sure they notice what's wrong. How many times have I ever coached a chamber music group and they finish a movement? I say, okay, how was that? They say, well, it was pretty good. Let's do the next movement. I say, no, it was really out of tune. Let's go back and take a look at that. Okay. Now, when I say that, I don't go say, you guys are crappy musicians. It's really out of tune. They're just students, for God's sake, you know? And even really good students can play really out of tune. As a matter of fact, even really good, great players can play really out of tune. The best thing Neville Marriner ever said in my time with him as music director at Minnesota was, they're the three things you don't talk to people about. They're driving, their sex life, and their intonation. So you got to go back and you got to say, let's look at this. What do we have here? I'm not afraid to bring out a tuner, but I always use a tuner in a very particular way. I always turn it on. I hold it up in front of the person who we're checking, and I tell the person next to them, avert your eyes. This is not about you, and I don't look at it. And I hold it there while they play the note. I said, did you get the information you needed? Yes. Good. Then we move on to the next person. Avert your eyes. Did you get the information you needed? I'm not there to embarrass anybody about their pitch. Of course, we talk about harmonic intonation. I know the tuner doesn't play in tune. I know all that. But on a wind instrument, muscle memory plays a great deal in terms of playing in tune on a wind instrument. But the important element of this, of course, is the lack of judgment. It's information. We're all on this path. We all want to get really, really good. But you're not going to get really, really good if you take it personally. And this is from me, and I'm terribly thin-skinned. I take things very personally. This has been difficult for me, a real trial. I've worked very hard on it.
I was actually very curious about your use of the word information, and I wondered if that's maybe a word that you use often in lessons, because what it triggers in me is it reminds me of a couple of studies I read recently in motor learning, where the researchers were really focused on how these different learning techniques provided more information. You know, essentially, it was a study where they had people do things incorrectly on purpose. And They found that doing things incorrectly on purpose in very specific ways, you know, trying to hit the ball out of bounds this way and then out of bounds the other way and so forth, like that actually led those participants to gain a lot more information about how to do things correctly relative to the ones who only try to do things correctly and didn't get all the information that they would have gotten by going to the edge and going beyond. And so I was just curious if that was a word that's maybe kind of a theme in your teaching that comes up when you talk to students.
I think increasingly so. You bring up something that I talk to students about a lot. And I got this from a great Alexander teacher named Michael Frederick, or have. You know, I still am in touch with Michael. And this is something he says are in Sanskrit texts. And I adapted this to my own use, okay? But I think the concept is there, and it's about how to come close to the unattainable ideal. So we're all looking for, we all want to be, you know, you want to be great. You want to be great, whatever you play. So how do you get there? Well, the way you don't get there is by taking little baby steps to get there. For starters, it's always moving because the unattainable ideal does not exist in our dimensional universe. It's always in motion. So you try to get there by these little steps. I'm going to get it right. 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 But the problem is those little steps, they get smaller and smaller and smaller. And ultimately, you just get all, it stops any motion. So the only way to get close to the unattainable ideal is to go past it. And so you go past it and you go, oh, I have now defined for myself what the unattainable ideal is because I know I passed it. So you go back again and you pass it on the other side. And it's a series of going of missing the mark, constantly redefining the mark, and gradually getting closer to the mark, with the understanding you never attain it, but hopefully you can get closer. But you have to continuously be doing this because, remember, it's always moving. So I think that this is something I encourage, which of course means you can't be afraid to make mistakes. You have to be willing to go in there, and you have to be willing to mess up, because how are you going to know what you're looking for? So I think that that goes along with what you were saying. It's information. Oh, that's a good piece of information. You know, student plays, they're playing something and a note doesn't respond. I have to deal with reads all the time. I'm a double read player. So a note doesn't respond. And you know, that's either you or it's your read. And the student, they're surprised because the note didn't come out. And I'll say, don't react to it. That's just good information for you to kind of chalk up here, continue playing. And you can refer to that when you put it all together as to what you ultimately want to do to fix it. People always say, I can't believe you waste all the time in your life making reads. I'm a bassoon player. Get over it, you know? I think there's a real danger, and I think this is a danger on any instrument, is to get this. Well, I got to play that passage in Zarathustra, your trumpet player. I got to go, bup, ba, da, beep. You know, you got to play that passage. I'm going to nail that high C. I'm going to nail that mother, you know? And the point is, all you start thinking about is, I'm going to nail that high C. Well, last time I checked, there are a lot of other notes on the trumpet than that note. And whenever we become fixated on one thing like that, you mess up completely. So I got this thing. Student comes in. I'm in a lot of trouble with my low E flat. Really a lot of trouble with it. I said, okay, a lot of trouble. Let's do this. Let's play a D major scale. So you play it. And I just like really get into how I'm going to get this read really. And you have to use your air. You have to do your homage. Everything would be great. You're going to play that D major scale. Great. Okay. So we do that. We spend some time on it. We get it. So everything's working, you know, really well. I said, okay, now play your low E flat. And they play their low E flat. Invariably, they can play it. Whereas if they had fixated on, and I choose D major for obvious reasons, there's not going to be an E flat in their world while they're doing that. And so this fixation on these small things, instead of seeing our playing in totality, making a judgment based on one mistake instead of taking this information into the totality, it's very dangerous. And you're just going down the proverbial rabbit hole when you do that.
I wonder if this ties back to something you were talking about earlier in terms of tension. I mean, is tension often one of the main issues that you see causing problems or leading to mistakes or difficulty with certain things on the instrument?
You got to be careful, because the opposite of tension would be relaxation. And there is nothing about playing a musical instrument that is about relaxation. You want to go to the beach. You want to have a beer and watch the ball game. You want to read a book. I don't care what that you find relaxing. That's great. But playing a musical instrument is not about relaxation. It's about efficient use of muscular activity. I mean, obviously, I'm not pointing to the artistic side of this. I hope that this entire conversation is predicated upon we're doing this for the music, you know, because this could easily come across like this guy's only interested in technique. And anybody who's heard me play knows that's not the truth. So it's just, how do we achieve it? I just wanted to put that there because that's primarily what we've been talking about here. Right. So I was talking about, we're looking for efficient use of your mind and your body together. Efficient use. You have to use muscular effort. You don't want to use too much. So a very standard thing I'll do in an Alexander class, usually in the first class, is I'll ask everybody to make a really tight fist. Really, really tight. Then I'll say, I want you to keep the structure of the fist, but ease off on what is not necessary to make the fist. And that's the kind of thing we're looking at in terms of playing a musical instrument. It's not that pluff. We're looking for the balance. So I might say unnecessary tension, but I don't think I would just say, well, you're really tense. Kid already knows they're really tense, you know. I was taking this Alexander lesson from somebody one time, and part of the Alexander technique is you lie on a table and a person works with you to help you to let go of unnecessary tension. And one of my habits is I'm tight in my hips, you know, the joint where my leg goes into my pelvis. A lot of people are. Anyway, I'm tight in my hips. I'd been told this by 5 people before. I was in the training at this point. Got me on the table, and the guy says, "Wow, you're really tight in your hips." And my inner eye roll goes, "Yeah, I've heard that before." And he keeps going, you know, he says, "Wow, you have a pathology there?" And at that point, I went, "We're going to finish this thing off, and the check's on the table there, and I'll catch you later." Because I'm just tight in my, you know, it's a habit of mine. I mean, if I worked on it, yeah. Am I better? Am I less tight in my hips now? Yeah, I'm less tight in my hips. Great. Is it something I work with? Yeah. Okay. There you go. But this judgment of, are you ill because you are tight in your hips? No. I mean, I'm probably ill in lots of ways, but that's not one of them. So that's the long answer to the question about tension.
It reminds me a little bit of my advisor in grad school. Specialized in family therapy, specifically with juvenile delinquents and their families between the ages of 12 and 18 who have been referred through the probation system. And so it's a very particular population generally who doesn't want to be seeing a psychologist. And, you know, his model was really predicated on reducing judgment. Like, it's not about whose fault it is and let's fix that person, but it was more about understanding, and part of the name of the model that he co-founded was functional family therapy. So kind of like the word information, it's like, what role is this playing? Is it functional? Is it not functional? Is it adaptive? Is it not adaptive? Not, is it good or bad or right or wrong, but just how is it working? And it sounds like that's maybe akin to how you're conceptualizing tension and release.
Yeah, I think that's true. Again, it's, what you do isn't going to help every person, you know. But I think pointing out, sometimes people aren't aware of it at all. And one of the ways people manifest it in music is they move around a lot when they play. Now, I'm not opposed to people moving around when they play. You know, if you feel the music, you know, you want to move to it. I understand. But when it starts to get in your way, and usually what it manifests then is, it's got to feel like I'm working really hard for me to feel like I'm musical. And so you see some people who are really musical just overdoing what they're doing. And most of it is that, yeah, it's got to feel right. And one of the things is that can be very misleading. Sometimes you help somebody to play and they go, "I don't feel like I'm doing anything." I'll say, "I know it feels strange to you because it's not what you're used to." But getting somebody to believe that they're still being musical, you know, because it doesn't feel tense or as tense, is something we encounter all the time. I'm not saying you aren't going to have to use some energy. Janet and I had a lot of trouble getting our Alexander work started at Rice because there was a well-known member of our faculty who had clearly had a bad experience with it. Probably they thought it was about collapse. They thought it was about relaxation, which nothing could be farther from the truth. And so they were a very respected teacher and very influential. But ultimately, we were able to get our classes at Rice. I like it because I get to meet so many different people at school.
I don't want to miss the opportunity to ask about reeds, because I know that's such a big thing for bassoonists and oboists. And I don't know that I know enough about the process to ask really intelligent questions about it, but I'm going to kind of give it a shot. I was watching the video that you have online about reed making, and there was something in it that I don't know if I understood it correctly, but I was really intrigued by it because it sounded a little bit like, and you know, you'll have to correct me if I get this wrong, but it sounded like one of the first steps, even before getting into reed making, is having a clear concept of sound.
Oh, absolutely.
I just wonder if you could say more about that, because that seems really important.
Well, I mean, you don't start a beginner at reed making. They have to gain a context for what are you looking for on the instrument. So what you do is you sell them reeds, or you give them reeds until they have a sense of how to blow through the instrument, because of how to form the muscular stuff that's required in your lips and your mouth, you know, which is called embouchure, but it's complicated because it involves that very large thing in your mouth, your tongue. But it's all related to the air of how to blow through a wind instrument. So until somebody's doing that, until they have some idea of what they're looking for on the instrument, there's no way they can do this little arts and crafts project, you know, even though some of them really like the idea of doing it. I had no interest in doing arts and crafts in terms of with reeds. My interest in becoming a reed maker had to do with I wanted to play with the toy, okay? The toy is the bassoon. I wanted to play with it. And no matter what some people will tell you, it's really hard to play a double reed instrument if you don't have a double reed that works. It's really hard to do that. So I needed to have a double reed that works. Then what happens? Oh, you get into the band and some guy tells you or gal tells you the note has to come out now. You mean it can't come out when I feel like it? Oh, it has to come out now, not now. Or now. Oh, you mean I got to make that little piece of wood help me do that? Okay, could be the way I blow. Okay, well, let's fix that. But it could be that little piece of wood. Okay, it's got to come out now. And now you're telling me it has to come out at a certain pitch that's like going to play it sound good with other people. So you got to play it so it's going to come out now and it's going to be in tune with the with people around you. Well, that's hard to do. So what do? You know, you're not going to be aware of that at first. At first, you know, everybody, all you're trying to do is get the thing to start, right? Violin, flute, whatever. You just try to get a note to go boop. Then we refine it in these other ways. Then you end up in an orchestra and you got a conductor really telling you, you got to play soft. I can't hear you. Got to play loud. I mean, that's not a problem for some instruments, but bassoon is a soft, you know, inherently soft. Oh, you got to figure all these things out. All right, well, I'm going to work with my breathing. I'm going to work with my technique. I'm going to work with my embouchure, but I also am going to work with my reeds. So the point is that it grows with you as a musician. And you can grow tremendously, but if it's impossible to do on the instrument because the twig, this twig that you're working with is holding you back. And I can't tell you at what point you adjust for it and it adjusts for you. But my teacher, Norman Hertzberg, had this thing. He said, you know, here's what you can do on the bassoon. Here's what the reed will do to help you. And there's always this gap. So you're trying to narrow that gap, but you're not going to do it all with your reed. You're not going to do it all with you. You know, this is totally applicable to I don't know how many other things in life. There's this balance between you changing and adapting, and you changing and adapting the inanimate or the external to be able to do what it is that you're trying to do. And people will take the path of least resistance unless somebody pushes them. And sometimes, unfortunately, people start pushing themselves more than they need to, and it makes them crazy. But double reed players, they're never crazy. You know that. Does that kind of address your question?
Yeah, absolutely. And this maybe leads to the question that I often get from folks, even though I don't have an answer for them, which is, you know, you're on stage or you had an audition, you're performing, and your reed's not behaving or it's not doing what it is that you would want it to do. And my understanding is you can kind of get into your head, right? Like you're sort of fighting against, you're trying to stay focused, trying to play the phrase, make beautiful music, but don't feel like your equipment's helping you out. And I wonder, how do you deal with that in the moment? How do you manage, how do you stay in a better headspace or more effective headspace and continue to play your best, even if your reed's not working the way that you would want it to?
Needless to say, I say this to my students, all things being equal, which they're not, that's the important element, which they're not, the person with the best reed will win the audition. Okay. Now, I'm not telling you the person with the best reed is going to win the audition because all things are not equal. But I do think that in the style in which you play, you choose to play, that's something you have a degree of control over. And therefore, I think that you have to do everything you can to control that. Okay, so you get into the audition and things aren't working great. Okay. That's when picking up quickly on the limitation of that reed. And I think this is probably true. You get into a situation, you're a string player, something's going on, the humidity changed, what your bow tension's not ideal. You can tell me what the situation is. You have to know what is the limitation of the equipment at the moment. gear your interpretation to that limit and then make the most of that. Is it going to feel like good? No. Is it going to feel like you've given 100% of what you could give musically to the circumstance? No. But ultimately, an audition or a concert is a snapshot of where you are at a given time. Now, how many times have you looked at a picture of yourself and go, oh, that's a really lousy picture of me? And the answer is a lot, right? I mean, that's true for all of us. But if you showed it to somebody else and you said, who is that? I said, oh, that's you, Noah. But look at my eyes are such and such. And you go, yeah, I guess they are a little bit. So you're dealing with a snapshot. And we look at every imperfection in that snapshot and we go, oh my God, look at that. You know, that hair right there is sticking out a little bit. Oh, look, it's sticking out a lot right now. So I recognize it is. So maybe I'll talk to you a little bit more like this. You see what I'm saying? You have to be flexible and you have to recognize what are the limitations of the situation and make the most of it in that moment. Hard to do because it's really hard. You know, you feel like you're sounding bad, but in essence, you still sound like you. How many times have you ever had somebody say, oh, I didn't advance in that audition because I missed this low F? Well, that's never the reason you didn't advance in the audition. I mean, it's my brother, Paul. I tell this story all the time. It kills him that I tell this story because he thinks he's being such a jerk when he did this to me. But and the thing is, I know my brother, and I know, again, for him, he just takes it as information. He says, you've won so few auditions yourself. How are you qualified to teach people to take auditions? Now, that sounds like my brother being a jerk. He really isn't. It's just his way of talking. I said, I made the cut, you know, passed the preliminaries in almost, I think, save one, every audition I've ever taken. That's all I can do to help a student do is for them to say, that person plays well enough and they're an interesting enough musician. We want to hear them again. I say, past that point, it's just a matter of taste. And sometimes they're just not looking for what you like. I mean, you've heard this in many different ways. The important part is to be able to help somebody to get past that first hurdle. And he said, yeah, that makes sense to me. Okay. So it's a reasonable answer.
I think you use the word flexibility, you know, cultivating the flexibility to be able to work within the constraints that read seems to be offering you at that moment. How does one develop that? I mean, do you deliberately try to do a round with a read that you know has some particular limits, or do you surprise yourself? I mean, is there a way to develop that sort of flexibility?
I don't think there is a double reed player on the face of the earth that has not sat down and played on a reed that was not helping them out very much at that moment. And so you develop for yourself, how much am I willing to adjust? And sometimes what's good to do is to say, I'm going to play on this thing for 10 minutes instead of, oh, I'm going to run to the reed desk and, you know, I'm immediately going to do blah, 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 blah. And the thing is, it does it for you because so often you've put in some time on a reed, you realize it's not going to be any good. You know, you've hit the point where it's limitation. You don't have anything else sitting up there on the rack right that moment. So what do? Okay, I'm going to continue practicing on this thing. And I'm going to make the best of the situation as I can, you know, until I get so disgusted with it. Now, honestly, when I was younger, I'd be more apt to do that. I don't have as much time left to play. I love to play. I play now, I practice now more on somewhat better reeds, but I'm always in process, you know, I'm always making them because making reeds is, it's part of the process of playing my instrument and you have to practice it. There's actually a lot of technique involved in, you know, craft technique of skilled labor. And that's why I spend time with people doing that. And I talk to them about how to use elements of the Alexander, their organization at the reed desk, so that it's not, because if you've ever, you know, I'm assuming anyone's going to watch this, it's going to be a musician, except maybe my siblings, maybe they'll watch it. You've seen people huddled over the reed desk like this, you know, and like Geppetto or something. And look what I'm doing when I do this. I'm collapsing at some joint that doesn't exist, which is in my spine. I'm pulling my head back and down, which is creating tension in my neck. I'm too close to the table. My arms are really close to my body. And I would point out to somebody, gee, that's probably not the most efficient way to accomplish what you're trying to do. Well, what do I do? Well, start by moving your chair back a foot. Oh, and bend at your hips instead of scrunch lean in here. I mean, these are little things. You see, this is one of the things I like about the technique, about the Alexander technique, is it's absolutely practical. There's no woo-woo involved in this. You got to bend in your hips. You don't have a joint here that's meant to do that. That's your back. It's there as your suspension system. It's not intended for that. Is it flexible? Yes, it's flexible, but that's not what it was made for. So you draw people's attention to this, and all of a sudden they have more control in their arms to be able to take off the cane where they intend to take it off.
It seems so obvious now in hindsight, but yeah, how much time you spend making reeds, it would make sense to apply Alexander technique to that as well. So I'm glad that you brought that up right at the end here.
You know, one of the classic things you do in an Alexander lesson is you help people to stand up and sit down from a chair. And anyone who's ever taken an Alexander lesson knows this is what it's about. Now, and one of the reasons for it is it's an activity that we all do every day, numerous times. And it's an activity that actually utilizes all the fundamental principles of the Alexander technique can be embodied in this one activity. It's really a standard. I do it all the time with all people. No, but I do it because they then begin to see the universality of what we're doing, how it applies to reed making, how it applies to cooking, how it applies to brushing your teeth, how it applies to, you know, everything, and how it applies to playing the violin or the bassoon, French horn, because how we move, the processes involved in movement are the same no matter what you do. But it's very important to remember there are no bad movements. There's nothing wrong with doing what you need to do to play a musical instrument, but you don't have to be there all the time. The trombone player doesn't have to walk around like this because they're pushing up on the trombone there all the time. But many of us do things like that.
You can tell me if this has an answer worth exploring or not, but I read an interview that you did with, I think, Boss Bassoon, and one of the things that you said was essential was slow practice, and it was in all caps. And I think all the teachers that we've ever studied would tell us to do more slow practice, but I don't know if we know what that means. I don't know if we're doing slow practice like right or correctly. And I wondered if you have any insight on like how to, because I think a lot of times we try slow practice and it feels like it doesn't do anything for us. So I assume that it's not because of the slow practice. We're just not approaching it in the right way. So I wondered if you could elaborate on maybe how to approach slow practicing in a more effective way.
Yes. I want to tell you one more story that I think you can appreciate. So I had a student, a really good player, a bit OCD, not unlike many musicians. And he said to me, I have practiced the Marriage of Figaro Overture, which, as you know, is a major excerpt for bassoon, some other instruments as well. It doesn't matter, but it was Figaro. 10,000 times slowly. He was so OCD, I suspect he actually had. And I always screw up the same place when I play it up to tempo. Sound familiar there, Noah? Okay. So I said to him, let's look at this. Because what a lot of people don't realize when they're practicing slowly is that they are developing the habitual tensions that they are going to then do when they do it fast. But they're developing it when they're practicing slowly. So what people don't do is they don't notice when they're playing, say, on one of the things in Figaro that's hard is you have to keep it very even and it's very soft, and you have to go over the register break, which is difficult on wind instruments because, you know, we're going from all our fingers up to all our fingers down, and you want to make it nice and smooth. Okay, so you have to go over the register break, and you want to make it smooth. So what he was doing is he knew that was coming up. It was that, or his thumb had to do something. I don't remember what it was that was making him nervous, and he's practicing it slowly. I'm going to get this. I'm going to do it slowly. But his hands are like, you know, tense as can be. And so what was he doing? He was practicing the unnecessary tension in a slow tempo. He could then play through the difficult part because it's slow and because he was in a low pressure circumstance, which was he was playing for himself in a practice room. As soon as he came in, tried to play it up to tempo, or as soon as he tried to play it for me or in an audition, he'd screw it up because what happens is he gets so tense and it gets exacerbated by the tension of the circumstance. He gets to the point where he can't do it every single time because what he had learned so well, he had practiced so diligently, was the unnecessary tension. So this, what you have to do when you're practicing slowly is this, you have to have the awareness of how is this manifesting itself through your whole self. And I would say you've practiced this tension so well, it's so natural to you. And the problem is, of course, he thinks that going over the break or whatever it was with his C sharp, he thinks that's the problem. No, that's the mistake. The problem happened a lot sooner. So what I did with him is I said, I need you to play until you feel somewhere in your body, because it's not up to me to figure where it is. You feel some sort of unnecessary tension. You know, sometimes, of course, it's before they even begin to play. He played along, played a few notes, whatever. And people invariably go past it. And you have to say, no, you went past it because they're not attuned to it. So he played it till you feel it. Then you stop. You, like I did with the fist, you let go of the unnecessary tension. You don't go back to the beginning. You start where you left off. Play slowly till you feel it again. You let stop. You let go of it. You could stop mid-note. And so gradually what I helped him to do, and this worked with people, I'm not going to tell you it works every time, is you gradually relearn how to play without as much of the unnecessary tension. The habit's always going to be there, less, and gradually he was able to learn to play Figaro. So that's the misunderstanding, one of the misunderstandings about slow practice there. But as you know, Noah, you can't just practice slowly. You have to be able to go do the hard thing up to tempo. That's where the faster practice of, but smaller segments so that you're not messing it up. Because you really don't want to play something wrong. Because then you have to go back and relearn it, you know, because you've trained yourself at least once.
You can get the full transcript of this week's chat, plus links to various things that came up in conversation, at bulletproofmusician.com/blog.